This one. All right. Alright, so I did complete the next round of questions to the Constitution. I sent that through an announcement, so you should have gotten that yesterday. The one for the executive officers, which is the longer part, that's due on Tuesday. And then I think there's only like 6 questions for the judiciary. So that one will be due on Thursday. Because what we want to do is we want to finish up the executive branch and then go to the judicial branch. All right. So we understand that governors across the country have lots of responsibilities, lots of duties that they have to engage in. And again, there is no two governorships that are exactly the same. Because of history, because of tradition, because of politics, etc., etc. But we can talk about what is in our own Commonwealth, and it's pretty straightforward, because we know going all the way back to the Charter of 1629, there always was a governor, a lieutenant governor, or actually back then they used to call it a deputy governor, and other executive officers that were entrusted with the responsibilities of managing the state. In the Commonwealth, our governor is a representation of that executive power. Essentially, as I said, the job is to run things. And whether it be the Charter of 1629 or the Province Charter of 1691, the governors have always had certain authority to basically run the show. They had veto power. They had appointment power. And ultimately, they were entrusted with faithfully executing the laws of the Commonwealth. Now, as our Constitution states, the job of the governor is to explain our, quote-unquote, country's needs. Because remember, when our Constitution was made, they viewed all of the individual states as countries. Our Constitution predates the United States. So, our governor is entrusted with representing the people before the legislative body, to suggest ways that the legislature represent the people. And ultimately, they have the ability to execute all matters that govern or impact the state as a whole. But the actual individual who has that position, in truth, only exercises a small part of their executive authority. Why? Well, the original power of the original governor has been delegated. As the tiny little province of Massachusetts Bay grew and multiple towns came in and they stretched all the way across the 200 odd miles that Massachusetts is wide, eventually resulting in 351 common municipalities, somewhere between 7 and 8 million people live within its borders. It's impossible for one person to execute all of the laws of the land. So it's only natural that the governor had to give up, to delegate portions of their authority. And interestingly enough, our Constitution does that expressly. Today,
there are 14 constitutional officers created by the Constitution to help the governor effectively execute the laws in the Commonwealth. And we're going to go through them all. We have the governor, lieutenant governor, the secretary of the Commonwealth, the attorney general, the treasurer and receiver general, the auditor, and the governor's council. 14 men and women work together to execute the laws of the state. Now, as you will see, because I'm going to make you look at it, in the original unamended Constitution, originally, only the governor and lieutenant governor were elected by the people. The Constitution, however, created other positions. And a couple of the other ones were created by statute. So, for instance, the Constitution calls for the creation of the position of the Secretary of the Commonwealth. The Constitution also calls for the creation of the position of, well, actually, technically, it's called the Treasurer and Receiver General. But as you will see, the people didn't originally vote for those offices. I'm not going to tell you how, no spoilers, you can look it up. Those are the questions, some of the questions that I ask. There also is the position of the Attorney General. Originally, the Attorney General was an appointed position. The Constitution also calls for the creation of what they call the Council, although technically it's referred to as the Governor's Council. The original mechanism of becoming a member of the Governor's Council is fascinating. Again, I'm not going to give you any spoilers, because that's in your homework. But it would be interesting if they did it today. And the last position, the auditor, that was actually created not in the Constitution. That was established in 1849 by statute, by law. But these are the 14 officers that make up the executive branch. And each one has a certain duty. Governor, to be the top dog. The head official of the state. Lieutenant governor. Well, the Constitution tells you their powers, but in theory, they're supposed to assist the governor. Secretary, supposed to record all official records. The treasurer, obviously deal with all the money. One of the most interesting elements, and we are one of only two states that have this, is the governor's council. John Adams and the framers of our Constitution here in the Commonwealth were so terrified of executive power, they intentionally put a check in the system that has the constitutional authority to basically prevent the governor from being a king, at least in theory. Although, of course, like everything, partisanship has polluted that system. And last but not least, the people of Massachusetts were so concerned about where our money was going, we demanded, and the general court responded with creating the auditor, whose job is it to look at all the Where's the money coming from and where's it going?
Well,
all of these positions would change over time in terms of how people got into office.
For example, in 1855,
the Seventh Amendment of our Constitution
was passed. Sorry, I thought I had them all broken down. I guess I didn't.
And in 1855, what ended up happening is the old way of getting into these positions was changed. They basically went from interesting ways of being appointed to being directly elected.
Why? Well, the people wanted to be able to vote for the secretary and the treasurer and the auditor and members of the governor's council. Then in 1919, the Constitution was changed again. Originally, all the executive positions served one-year terms.
Why 1 year? Well, John Adams, when he designed the original Constitution, wanted to give the people the ability to throw the bums out. If they didn't work well, they're gone next year. Well, the politicians didn't like that. So in 1919, they gave all of the executive officers two-year terms.
And then in 1964,
politicians responded again, and they made the governor, the lieutenant governor, the secretary, the treasurer, the attorney general, and the auditor have four-year terms, which is what they have now. And then the last major change occurred in 1966, where the Constitution was amended so that way the governor and the lieutenant governor ran as a ticket. So you can't split your vote. Because the Democrats didn't want it that way, because by 1966, the Democrats had taken over our state. So now, if you go in to vote on the general election day, you either vote for the Democrat ticket, or the Republican ticket, or the rainbow ticket, or the Libertarian ticket. You can't say, well, I like the Democrat governor candidate, but maybe I like the Republican lieutenant governor more. You can't do that. That's prohibited under our amended Constitution.
Day one of the new term begins at noon on the Thursday following the first Wednesday in January after the election. I'll read that again because it's really convoluted. I don't know why they put this in there. I've not found a good source that explains the thought behind this. So every 4 years we have a gubernatorial election. That governor's term begins on at noontime on the Thursday following the first Wednesday after the election.
First Thursday after the first Wednesday. Actually, I suppose it could be the second Wednesday. Thursday, rather. So it's Thursday following the first Wednesday in January. So the first Wednesday in January is the 6th. So whoever wins the gubernatorial race this November, the first day is January 7th. It's quicker than presidential. inauguration day. Presidential inauguration day is January 20th.
That's true. But I mean, it's still, it's about as late as it can almost be in January.
Well, I mean.
The Thursday after the first Wednesday?
Yeah.
Hey, it could be the 8th.
Well, yeah, I know. It could be. It could be. Some years it is. One of the reasons why they have that is, if you recall, the legislature begins on a Monday. So I think the idea is you get the general court in there and settled, then you bring in the governor.
Well, of course, I also like how they
Oh, yeah, exactly. You can't do work if you're a politician during the holidays.
Oh, no, no, no.
Yeah, no, unlike us plebs, you know, we all have to go to work regardless. I got you. I got you.
All right, questions?
All right. Let's give you some details about the current position of governor.
Again, you're going to go through the questions. I think for the governor section, I think I gave you a 10. Many of the responsibilities are still there, but obviously the term, the qualifications, those have since changed.
Of course, as you know, our current governor, at least I hope you know, is Maura Healey, Democrat. Our Constitution declares
that our governor is the supreme executive magistrate.
The supreme executive magistrate.
So meaning, magistrate, government official, this description essentially alludes to the fact that they are the top member of the executive branch.
Of course, they are stylized as being called the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. But interestingly enough, John Adams sprinkled in
how we as citizens should refer to our governor. Oh man, I gave you the answer to a question. Shit, because that's one of the questions I asked. I just realized that. Our Constitution mandates that the official title when you speak to and about our governor should be His Excellency.
And no, it has not been amended to say I don't do the pronouns thing, so I don't know how they there. I think that would be the non-gendered way of expressing it.
So if you ever meet Maura Healey, you have to say His Excellency. I would hope she would get a chuckle out of that, because that would kind of show that you actually know, you know, the Constitution, but who knows.
Qualifications have changed. Wait till you see what the qualifications were to be governor originally in the Constitution. Of course, that has been amended. Today, you must be obviously
capable of being registered to vote. So that means you must reside in Massachusetts, have to be over the age of 18. You can be a man, you could be a woman, you could be of any racial background.
But the catch is, you have to reside in Massachusetts for the 7 years immediately prior to the election.
So if you want to run in 2026, you had to have been living here since 2019. Now, interestingly enough, Mitt Romney got himself into a little bit of controversy. Because before Mitt Romney ran for governor, he was actually out in Utah running the Salt Lake City Olympic Games. So there were actually questions as to whether or not the fact that he owned a house here was actual residency. Because under the tax laws, to be considered a resident of the state, you must physically be in the state for 50% plus one day of the calendar year. If you have to go and work in another state, and you are in that other state for more than 50% of the calendar year plus one day, you, for tax purposes, are considered a resident of that state. It's going to work great next year for my daughter. She's working down in Florida. So she will not have to pay Massachusetts income taxes next year. Well, Mitt Romney was out in Utah for five of the quote-unquote 7 years, but it didn't really manifest into too much.
All right. Governors get paid a good amount of money. The last time I checked this, and I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure it's actually more. Oh, wait, no, we can do this. We can check this. Come on, come on, come on, phone, work with me. Don't work against me. Ba-ba-ba, new tab. Salary. Governor. Massachusetts. Oh, no, it's the same. All right. So the current salary of Maura Healey, she gets paid a flat rate of $185,000, plus she receives $65,000 in housing expenses. As I told you before, we are one of the few states that does not have a governor's mansion because the Sons of Liberty burnt it down in a symbol of defiance during the Revolution. But the governor basically gets enough money that's a decent salary. That's actually a really good salary. That's more than the full-time faculty get here, just as a stipend for living expenses. Crazy. All right, now, most of the governor's authority comes directly from the Constitution. With, of course, the rest coming through laws enacted by the legislature. The governor of the Commonwealth has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11
key powers. 11 key powers.
Power number one.
It's the governor who presents the budget. Constitution requires the governor to present the budget.
The legislature, general court.
They must do that annually. FYI, do any of you know how governmental budgets are put together? I think we'll talk about it when we get to the bureaucracy. But pretty much what happens is the governor has to send word out to the different department heads, and the different departments, you know, have their estimated budgets, operation expenses, salaries, all the rest. And it's the job of the governor to basically put them all together and then send that to the House.
Because, of course, the House initiates all spending bills.
Now, interestingly enough, our governor has been given the line item veto solely for budgetary purposes. So the governor's first power, they present the budget. Two, they have a line item veto for just the budget.
meaning when the general court passes their budget, it then goes to the governor's office, and the governor can either increase line items or decrease items, individual line items. Yes?
It's kind of more of a comment, but this just reminded me. So over the weekend, I was at a conference, and I met Wes Moore.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know, just reminded because I know, like, he just dropped to, like, under, like, 48% on his ratings, and it just, like, mostly about budgets, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah, the legislature?
Yeah.
Yeah, our see, what happens is a lot of people don't pay attention to what's going on because life's complicated. Right, I know you've shared a little bit of what you've gone through in the last couple of years. Do you think you're going to have time to pay attention to what's going on in the news? No, you're very worried about yourself, your family, and all the rest. You know, we worry about our health, we worry about our own bills. It takes a lot of time to sit back and actually read in the newspapers what's going on, because even the newspapers don't tell all the truth. So if you can't get the truth from the newspapers, okay, we're going to put on the TV. Well, the TV doesn't tell all the truth. So that means we then have to go to, like, individual bloggers and online sources. So in order to be knowledgeable, you have to spend more hours are there in the day. But there are some big stories that are starting to break out. And again, I've mentioned it a bunch of times. Just the audit alone. You know, they keep telling us, and again, they being the majority party in Massachusetts, the Democrats, they tell us we're a democracy. But what do they actually do for the people? You know, we want to know where our money's going. And our state leaders said, we don't care. So yeah, I think if you were to actually do a more broader poll, I think the approval rating would be less. Because of course, when they do polls, they only ask like 1,000 people or something like that. But I think one of the good positive things that came out of COVID is that more alternative news sources appeared, and more people are having different sources that they can go to that's showing other sides of stories, and people are slowly becoming more informed. By the way, I would suggest, if you have the time, one of my favorite state political blogs is a blogger by the name of Mike Urban. He is a centrist. He is not a Democrat. He is not a Republican. He'll bash both sides. He's only interested in the reality, the truth. And some of his recent stories that he's been talking about. We are in dire straits. So I think as more of that stuff breaks through. You know? Yeah. And you know what the solution is? Don't you? What's the solution? You're removing people. Don't keep sending the same fools back in. But I'm glad you went to a conference. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
You're trying to be informed. All right. Another power. The governor, of course, has the qualified negative veto. You have a line item veto for the budget, but they also have the qualified negative veto, where they can veto any piece of legislation that comes out of the general court. Now, of course, we know the governor just can't say no. The governor has to say why they are opposed to the legislation, so that's the qualified. And of course, the general court has the ability to override that veto. What percentage in both chambers? To override a governor's veto, what percentage of votes must take place in the general court?
I'm thinking two-thirds.
Two-thirds, yeah, exactly, two-thirds. All right, power number four. The governor can recommend the timeline for loans to the state.
A governor can recommend a timeline for loans to the state. So if the state needs to borrow money, it's up to the governor to determine how many years should it take us to pay it back. So think about this. You're going to go buy a car. You go to a dealership. You have multiple options in front of you. You could either pay for it all out of pocket up front, or you can finance it. And I think the dealerships typically offer loans like you could get a 3%, a 3-year loan or a 4-year loan. I think cars go all the way up to 7-year loans. When you go out and buy a house, banks offer 10-year mortgages, 15-year mortgages, 30-year mortgages. Well, if you're going to go borrow, you make that decision. Well, if the state needs to borrow, it's up to the governor to decide how many years that term is going to be. Five. The governor can call special sessions of the general court. The governor can call for special sessions of the general court. Now, in the modern Commonwealth, this rarely, if ever, happens because we are one of the few states, as I've mentioned, that our general court is almost always in session. We have a full-time legislature, which is one of the reasons why they basically screw us over every single year, because they're always there causing shenanigans. But there are times when they do recess, typically around holidays. So again, if you pay attention, you'll see that every single year, pretty much our general court shuts down, usually like the first week in December, and then they come back the next year. They also typically recess in around usually late August, early September, just so that way they all can go out and campaign for re-election. But when they are in recess and there's an emergency, the governor does have the authority to call them back. Now, back when the Constitution was made, we did not have a full-time legislature. The delegates of the general court came from as far away as Maine. So they would only meet for a few months at a time out of the year. But again, if there was an emergency, the governor would have the ability to call them back. Not only does the governor have the power to call them in for a special session, the governor also has the power to adjourn the legislature. In other words, the governor has the power to send them home. But here's the catch, because of course there's always a catch. In order for the governor to adjourn, or there's another phrase in there, they call it prorogue, that means to postpone. In order to either end or postpone a session, they have to get a request by the leadership. So the Senate President, the House Speaker, must send a request to the governor. And he has to receive the advice and consent of the Governor's Council. The advice and consent of the Governor's Council. In other words, there are 9 people that make up the Governor's Council. 8 counselors and the Lieutenant Governor.
whenever you see that reference for the advice of the council, that's implying there has to be a majority vote. Now, why not just let the governor just shut things down? Well, you have to look back in English history. One of the rights that's contained in the Magna Carta is that the crown doesn't have the authority to suspend the parliament. Only the parliament does. And it was actually, that was one of the triggers of the English Civil War, which culminated in King Charles I literally getting his head cut off. Well, John Adams, unlike the most of us in modern history, he actually knew our history. And he felt that it was very important, that he didn't want to give one person the power to shut off the representatives of the people. So, governor can do it if the speaker and the president request it, and the council approves it.
Questions on that one?
Next power.
The governor is the presiding officer of the governor's council.
The governor is the presiding officer of the governor's council. But does not have a vote. The governor is not allowed to vote on any matter that appears before the governor's council.
Questions on that one? We got four left.
The governor can grant pardons. With the advice of the council.
Governor can grant a pardon. So if you are arrested and you are sent to prison for committing a crime, the governor has the authority to pardon you. But any pardon must get a majority vote by the council.
The governor
can appoint all judicial officers.
So judges, justices of the peace,
with the advice of the council.
The governor is the commander-in-chief of the military forces of the Commonwealth and has the authority to appoint. Oh, what was the point? What did they refer to? The commanding officer of the militia or the National Guard. The term was in there. Not advisory general, I can't remember what it was. Administrative general, no, I don't remember. But the governor is the commander-in-chief, but basically they can appoint the heads of both the land forces and the naval forces with the advice and consent of the council.
Or with the advice of the council. One last one.
The governor can appoint all of the major department heads
and remove them. The governor can appoint all heads of all of the state departments
and the governor has the power to remove them.
Some require the advice of the council, but most do not.
Questions? Now, most of those powers, you will see, because I think that's one of the questions I ask you. What are the constitutional powers? You've got to dig, but they're all in there. Many of them are still the same.
All right. Another interesting power of the governor is the governor has the power to reorganize the government structure.
So let's say we have two governmental departments, two agencies. Again, these are just hypothetical. Let's say there's a government agency responsible for picking up the trash on state land, and then there's another department that's responsible for cutting the grass at all state parks. Well, obviously, if you have a government department, we're spending millions of our tax dollars because every single department has to have staff, has to have, you know, managers and administrators. Well, let's say in this hypothetical, the governor decides it doesn't make sense to have two departments that overlap. Well, the governor has the authority to merge the departments together, streamline things.
The governor also has the authority to
propose new departments. So maybe a new government agency is necessary.
One of the most newest government agencies that has been created is the acronym is POST. Police Officer Standards something or other.
I don't remember what the acronym is. Hold on. POST. Massachusetts. Oh, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission. The Peace Officer Standards and Training
Commission. This is one of the newest departmental agencies. This was created in the wake of the so-called Summer of Love 2020. When mobs of people were going across the country calling for the defunding of police.
So Massachusetts responded by making this commission, and this commission is entrusted with basically regulating the standards that go into the training of police officers.
Maura Healey was not governor when it was created. Charlie Baker was, but Maura Healey was the Attorney General. She advocated for it, and Charlie Baker basically endorsed it.
Why? Well, this was a response to the outrage. Well, I can tell you, I know lots of cops. There are many, 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 many good cops that are basically quitting their jobs because of this agency. Because if any of you are thinking about becoming a cop, post the creation of POST, you basically have to do five times as much paperwork as you used to have to do. Any action that you engage in has to be documented. So what's happening is a lot of cops are just kind of not wanting to get involved. Because if they don't have to respond to something, they don't have to do paperwork. And then the paperwork has to get reviewed. And if there's any action that was in or occurred in any incident, It gets reviewed in station, and then it has to be reported to post. And then you have bureaucrats in Boston that review the situation. And good cops. And I'm not even saying a cop that does something bad. But a cop that just does something that, maybe he just went a little too far. Could lose their job, they could lose their pension, and they could be subject to criminal investigation. Well, that's the bureaucracy that we have in Massachusetts. So it's a shame. But again, that was done at the suggestion of the governor.
I hope at some point a future governor will realize that by giving that board all of that power, you're going to hurt everybody. Because you know what happens when you don't have good men and women wanting to become cops?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have people that aren't quite up to it. Or you have people that don't take the job.
One last example. So, again, as I mentioned, I'm the chairman of the Board of Selectmen in my town. We had a vacancy in our department when I first got on the board. And there were about 90 applicants. This was 2017. 16? 17? I don't know. I've lost track. I've been on it for too long, I think. Shit, actually, it was longer than that. 2012? 14? Whatever. But the last time we had one open, a few months ago, we got two applicants. Do you think you're going to get the best of the best if you get two applicants for a job? And then who's going to suffer if you don't get the best of the best? The residents of your community.
All right. Sorry, I don't mean to go off on those tangents, but again, I do this in real life, and these are just things that I've observed.
Cabinet system. One of the more recent changes to our governmental executive branch occurred in 1966 when the Constitution was amended to pave the way for the creation of a cabinet system. Very similar to what we have in our executive branch at the federal level. We currently have 9 cabinet positions. These are individuals selected by the governor with the advice of the council, to head up the top position in 9 basic buckets of government agencies based on, to make it simple, themes. So for instance, one of the state secretaries is the secretary of administration and finance. Administration and finance. So underneath that secretary are all of the state agencies that deal with finance or government operations. Hiring, state personnel, regulations.
There also is the Secretary of Education.
Secretary of Education oversees all of the different agencies that deal with education, including DESE, Department of Education and Secondary Education. There's the equivalent agency for state colleges. There is one for community colleges. There's one for like UMass system. All of those agencies report to that secretary.
There's also, not that you need to remember these, there's Energy and Environmental Affairs, Health and Human Services, Housing and Economic Development, Labor and Workforce Development, Public Safety and Security, Transportation, and Technology Services and Security.
So these cabinet members, their job is to basically oversee the operations in all of those departments that fall under their authority. and report up. So they're supposed to go and visit the agencies. They're supposed to check in. Are they doing their job? Do they need any modifications? And then they report that to the governor. The cabinet is also the system that the governor can utilize, you know, their desired policy goals. So maybe there's a particular initiative that an individual governor thinks is important. Well, they will report it from top down by going through the cabinet secretaries.
Now, interestingly enough, there was no prior requirement for this.
But Massachusetts was one of the last states not to have a cabinet system, and it was just put in there because our bureaucracy was just growing and growing and growing. You want to know how scary it is in Massachusetts? We have one government employee for every 9.5 residents. There is one employee, either a town employee or a state employee, for every 9.5 residents. Well, think about it. I'm a state employee. If you go to UMass Hospital, that's a state hospital system, all of those nurses and doctors, they're all state employees. The police, the highway people, MassDOT.
But of course, that does beg the question, when is there too much government?
As I mentioned, one of the other powers of the governor, and this is true with all governors, is the power of appointment. Now, we're not going to get into it because there are too many boards and commissions and agencies, but anything that falls under the executive branch, the governor has the power to appoint the heads of those agencies.
Some of those agencies, the members get state salaries. Some of them are paid because they're short-time commissions paid for grants.
Some of them are voluntary. But if there's a vacancy, the governor has the authority to appoint the heads.
And how many?
Currently in Massachusetts, there are over 500 boards and commissions.
And each one tasked with doing different jobs.
In total, the governor has the authority to appoint over 2,500 people that sit as the presiding officers over all these boards and commissions.
All responsible to the executive branch. I've already said this, I've talked about this. I might have to redo it. Or maybe I just know this stuff a little too well. Now, by the way,
the one area that the governor cannot appoint is the governor doesn't have the authority to appoint staff for the other four executive officers. So the secretary, the treasurer, the attorney general, the auditor, those elective positions, those are the heads of those constitutional departments, and they have the authority to appoint their staff. So, for instance, the governor can't appoint an assistant attorney general. That's the job of the attorney general. The governor can't appoint staff in the auditor's department. That's the job of the auditor.
All right, what does all this mean? Well,
because we have nearly a million state and local employees that work on the taxpayer's dime, how can the governor actually oversee all of these employees? Truth be told, they can't.
Why? Sheer number.
So that's one of the reasons why they created the bureaucratic structure. So if you are a ranking member of any department, obviously you have management that you report to. Well, those managers reported to the department heads, and the department heads reported up to the secretaries of the different cabinet positions, and then it reports up to the governor.
But the governor, because of the size of the bureaucracy, cannot actually micromanage. Maura Healey cannot go into the Department of Parks and Recreation and tell a local park ranger, you need to cut a new trail through the woods.
Governor doesn't have that ability.
You're never going to have to worry about driving on 290 and have a state police cruiser come up behind you and have the governor yelling out the window, woo, 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 to pull you over. All right, I think I pretty much covered anything. Any questions on the governor?
Powers and responsibilities. All right, here's an interesting thing. What happens if the governor dies or resigns?
Who is next up?
Lieutenant governor. Lieutenant governor. It doesn't define it in these words, but the Constitution kind of strongly implies the only real major power of the lieutenant governor is to have a heartbeat. Because in the event that the governor dies, lieutenant governor becomes acting governor.
Acting governor. But what happens if the acting governor dies? Who's up next? Lieutenant governor is the first in line. Second in line is the Secretary of the Commonwealth. The Secretary of the Commonwealth. The third is the Attorney General. The Attorney General. The fourth is the Massachusetts Treasurer, or the Treasurer and Receiver General, the Treasurer.
The fifth, the Auditor, State Auditor.
So Lieutenant Governor, Secretary, Attorney General, Treasurer, Auditor.
Now, have we ever had a situation in our history where all of our executive officers were dead? No. No, we never had that. At most, either one of the individual lesser officers are died, but that didn't impact the governor's position. Or the governor resigned or passed away. I think three governors died in office, but several have resigned. In fact, there was a stretch there that none of the governors were even filling out their terms. Bill Weld, governor, he resigned to become an ambassador. Paul Salucci resigned to become an ambassador. Mitt Romney only ran one term. Deval Patrick was actually going to be tapped at one point by Barack Obama to potentially either be a Supreme Court justice or the Solicitor General for the United States, but that fell through. So we almost lost that. But it's weird. The people get in office and you think that they would want to stay and fulfill their term. But no, the moment they get in one office, of course, they're already looking for the next gig. So
God forbid, hope nothing ever happens, because that would be pretty scary if the auditor had to become governor. Because that meant there's five people that died or bailed on us. So what is going on in Massachusetts? All right, we're not going to be able to get through all the other executive officers, but
we'll deal a little bit with the lieutenant governor and the governor's council, and then we'll call it a class.
We, oh, by the way, the current lieutenant governor is Kim Driscoll. This was a position that was actually mandated by King Charles I. When the London Company was proposing to establish a colony in the New World, the original charter, when it was proposed, called for the creation of a governor and the general court. But at the governor, I mean the king's insistence, because after all, these people were going into the wilderness. Remember, there was nothing here. A few households, but that was about it. They literally had to build everything that they came across. And obviously, when you go into the wilderness, there's a good chance you're gonna die. So the king actually insisted that the only one of the terms that he was going to approve the charter was if a lieutenant governor was named. Of course, originally it was called a deputy governor. For this primary purpose. Just in case something happened to the governor, someone could take over. Now, when you look at the Constitution and I ask you what are the two primary powers of the lieutenant governor, you will see there is very little, which strongly implies the lieutenant governor and what they are supposed to do is largely determined by the governor. So, our previous governor, Charlie Baker, and our current governor, Maura Healey, have relied more on their lieutenant governors than any of their predecessors. Again, here we go. Here is a bipartisan sign of approval. Both the governors and the lieutenant governors, the past two administrations, they constantly are going out around the state trying to meet with as many people as they can. Although Maura's administration is not even close to what Charlie and Karen did. Again, they went to all 351 twice. But they're constantly out there. Why? They're out there advocating for their policies. They're out there trying to, you know, press the flesh, as it were. Shake hands, kiss babies, what politicians do. And to me, that's a positive thing. There's nothing worse than a politician that hides away in their office. No. You want them going out and interacting with the people. Because that gives the common man or woman the ability to grieve, to complain, ask questions. So it's nice to see. Because like Duvall, when he was governor, he had his lieutenant governor, Tim Murray. Tim Murray actually had to resign. He had a drinking problem. So there's been some controversy. But at least the last two administrations, they're trying. Even if you don't agree with their politics. Now, thanks to our constitutional amendments, particularly the last change in 1966, a ticket is elected. So, just like the governor, the lieutenant governor serves 4-year terms. And the requirements are identical. So that means you have to be registered to vote in Massachusetts, which of course means you must live here, you must be over the age of 18. And you must reside within the state 7 years prior to Inauguration Day. The Constitution grants to the Lieutenant Governor the honorary title of His Honor. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Constitution states that if there's a vacancy in the governor's position, it says the lieutenant governor becomes acting governor. But if there is a vacancy for lieutenant governor, that position stays vacant. It's not filled until the next election.
So when Tim Murray resigned after, well, he claimed he was suffering from a medical issue, so he had taken too much Ambien or something like that. But he got busted out by, I think he was up in Hudson. He was near one of the reservoirs. He got busted. He was doing like 90 miles an hour in like 25 mile an hour zone. But he resigned. That was like the first year into Duvall's second term. So for 3 years, Duvall had no lieutenant governor. If the lieutenant governor goes up, as I said, they become acting governor.
What exactly does that mean? Well, they are allowed to discharge the powers and fulfill the duties of the governor,
but they actually do not take an oath. They don't assume the position. They just act. So technically, they are still the lieutenant governor.
But again, if you get all the rights, all of the powers, you know, what's the difference? And last click, because we've hit the window.
Other than having a heartbeat and basically doing whatever task the governor wants you to do, the other actual power of the lieutenant governor is they are a member of the governor's council.
They may vote
unless... No, actually, no, even if they are acting. Because if the governor's not there, they can serve as the acting presiding officer. But in that instance, they could still vote, because we have 8 members of the council, so the lieutenant governor makes the odd number. But that's about it. So I don't have time to do the council, but we'll do the rest of the offices when we come back on Tuesday. Any questions? So please have assignment number 3. Done. I think there's about 20 questions total. We go through all the constitutional officers, we'll review that. We'll finish up the executive branch, then we'll go down to the judicial branch. And then on Thursday, the 6 or 5 questions from the judicial branch, we'll go over that, and then we'll finish the judiciary branch. And then we just got to deal with the bureaucracy, and we'll have exam number 3. They're not visible? Oh, I graded them all. I might have to hit a button. I apologize. I thought I had it set that when I graded all of them, they opened up. Because I graded them all, and I thought they were visible. But I'll check it. All right, also papers. Deadline for papers is coming up. The early submission. Early submission. I think it's next Friday, I think. That's the deadline to get the extra 10 points. But the paper itself is due, like, in May. All right. A wonderful weekend. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.